Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is the live Q&A 33. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I'm doing well. And someone in the chat just said, man bun Andrew. Oh my God, I would pay to see that. Someone, hey, one of our Photoshop people, can you?
Yeah, I don't think I'm a man bun kind of guy.
I don't think you are either, which is why it would rule. I just want to see it. I'm a fan of the man bun. That can be an attractive look, I think. But I think, is it already gone? Are we already done with that? Is that past?
Yeah, that's it. That is man bun. Man bun has gone the way of the romper, I think. So
yeah, that was like a year or two for the man bun. Yeah. Maybe three. Yeah. Stretch out a little bit. Yeah, I don't see
the romper. I think had one season, and
now I think we all just have a look which is brutally beaten down by life. I think that's the fashion.
Yeah.
Just absolutely dejected, like I didn't do anything to my appearance. Is that I think that's what's in right now. So we're doing that.
There you go.
So, all right, we're good. We're golden. We're going. We of course have the first question, as always, by the wonderful Teresa Gomez, and I will pop over to that. Teresa Gomez asks, if you had to get matching OA themed tattoos, what would it be?
Ooh, I know I have 100% know exactly what I would propose, but what are you thinking, Thomas?
I'm going to combine two things because I really am into this. There was an idea floated. I can't remember if it was by Teresa or someone on Teresa's post about the official OA poster. And I think that should be a badass Taint Team, like action movie poster, and we get all the characters, you know, with the Taint Team and the van and all that. And that I think would make an equally good tattoo. What were you gonna say?
I was thinking Optimus Prime and Negatron, but look, Taint Team.
That's really good too.
We could do the logo right with the van, and
we only get one tattoo? I mean, people are riddled with them. Nowadays,
right across on the neck, maybe. On
well,
the,
what should know. We? Do? What should the OA tramp stamp be officially? What should that?
I don't know that I could rock the tramp stamp. I'm working on it.
Oh, man, you get Andrew with that man bun and that tramp stamp, and
bun and a tramp stamp. Yeah, that's a alternate
uncomfortably
Star Trek
attractive
evil
to me.
Evil universe Andrew. There we go.
All right. And now our second question by not Teresa Gomez. Here we go. The Confederate monument that needs removal most is Mitch McConnell asks, if you could be the lawyer for any case in history on either side, what case and why? Ooh, what a good question.
Ooh, I like that question. I have never thought about that, right? Like,
I'll give you time. I got a good answer real quick.
Filibuster for you.
Marbury v. Madison, I'll argue the other side and just end this whole thing. I'll nip it in the bud. I'll win the case the other way for Marbury v. Madison, and then there's no Supreme Court or opening arguments or whatever. That wouldn't be great.
Thomas has picked, I would go back in time and murder my own grandfather.
Pretty much. So. Yeah.
I like it.
Dog agrees with me.
Yeah, law dog agrees with you. That's the way it goes. I appreciate that filibustering. Obviously, I wouldn't want to take any of the like fantastic cases in history that
you don't
want to
mess
so
them
much.
Up.
Yeah, yeah, because right, yeah, that's like going to visit Hitler and like you know.
Yeah. I know. I don't trust myself to do any time travel. I wouldn't want to be involved in any of it because I'm going to mess something up.
Yeah, well, look, if I could stop off, that's Alexa saying that, you know, someone's at the door.
Could there be any more noise on your end of the thing? Can you get another, like a kid running around screaming and a...
Yeah, clown horns going off. Yeah, there's all sorts of shit. This is look, this is what you get when you turn into a live Q&A, all right?
Yeah.
In terms of time travel, right, I could stop off, make sure that grunge never develops as a musical form.
Hey. Stick to the question.
That's truly
stick to the question, Torres.
To me.
May I remind you, you're under oath?
Most people who are not Jay Sekulow, who argue regularly before the Supreme Court, are good at it, right? Ted Cruz was good at it. when he was Solicitor General of the state of Texas, right? He argued like 17 cases before the Supreme Court. And like, again, I'm no fan of our good friend Ted Cruz, but like, you get to be good at it. The case that I feel like I'd love to take another swing at, not that I think I could get it, reversed, but hopefully I could pick off Kagan and Breyer, and it's on my mind because of today's Supreme Court rulings, but would be the Trinity Lutheran decision, right? Mm. I don't think that oral argument was very good. I don't think we went through the briefs with UB the Supreme Court, right? Like, knowing now that they needed to be beefed up, that you were in danger of losing, you know, half of the court's liberal bloc, I think I could have blocked that out and made the case entirely about Lemon, right? Lemon versus Kurtzman and Locke versus Davey, and just said, look, we should treat this case super narrowly, and this court should reject accommodationism as an illegitimate principle invented by Antonin Scalia in angry dissents and about to become law. So that's what comes.
Yeah,
to mind.
That seems. I wonder why that's on your mind currently. Mm-hmm. Possibly there's a Tuesday show about, or a Thursday recording coming up about that. Maybe. All right, let's go to. Well, we've answered stuff like this before, but it's been a while. Why don't we do it again? Okay. Joe Camel 3.14159 essentially asks,
Joe what, Camel Pie. Yeah.
Yep. What would you consider to be the most realistic courtroom movie/TV show, and why is it Night Court?
I did grow up when Night Court was in first runs. I was too young to be allowed, because it came on, I think, at 10 o'clock at night. And I was allowed to watch The Cosby Show and the stuff that followed it. I think they moved. It was must-see TV. I think they moved Family Ties at one point. I don't know. It's
Man,
been
remember
a long
it was
time.
Okay to like The Cosby Show? God,
yeah,
I this is a good show.
the best quip ever. I'm sorry, we have to do that. Sure. If you haven't heard this, but I think it was when Eddie Murphy was back re-hosting Saturday Night Live, and his quip was, you know, if you had told me 30 years ago when I last hosted the show that in 2020 that Eddie Murphy would be the beloved family comedian and voice of a cartoon donkey, yeah, and Bill Cosby would be in prison. Like, I'm not sure I would have believed you.
Yeah, no kidding. Gosh.
Which I thought was
he was America's dad, good. Wasn't he?
He was America's dad. Everybody that it did. There's so much we could do a deep dive just on what the Cosby Show meant to like white people. And again, like normalizing, right? Like having all of a sudden like tens of millions of people had a black friend, and I think that did a lot. Anyway, enough filibustering on that. I was not allowed to watch Night Court because it came on at 10 o'clock, but I did watch a lot of it in reruns, and I thought it was super funny back then. No idea. I've literally not seen it since childhood, so
I've
no
never
idea
seen an episode. Don't know anything
how well
about it
holds up. Harry Anderson has like turned into an asshole, I think. He was the comedian. This
know
is
who
one
that
of like
is
the first comedian vehicle shows. He was a comedian. He was a juggler. He did like shitty magic tricks. And his shtick was he was the youngest judge appointed to the bench, and it was just your standard like district court, you know, street crime kind of stuff. So they had like wacky crime things.
I gotta say, Peter Gerdes with a good joke in the chat. Well, that's appropriate. America's dad probably should be in prison.
That's an excellent joke.
That is a good joke.
All right. So for those of you who are late to the party, most realistic courtroom TV show is the first 4 to 5 seasons of Law & Order.
Oh, I thought because you always had L.A. Law or whatever. Wasn't that true?
No. First 4 to 5 seasons of Law & Order, in particular, when Adam Schiff, no relation, that's such a great like happenstance on names. But when he was the DA, and his catchphrase was "Make the deal," it was perfect. So that was best TV show in terms of accuracy. I gotta tell you, like, a lot on Better Call Saul is
really good, man.
We need to do that. We need to talk about that.
Can we do a positive lawful good movies?
There you go.
Because it's great. I love that show.
Yep. And
How far are you into that, by the way?
Oh, I'm through it now. Yeah.
The whole thing?
Yep.
So you saw the most recent season with what's his name?
I have. Yeah.
Oh my God, he was the best. That was the best character. Why am I blanking? I posted about him like when we were watching it. The hell's his name? The guy, he's fantastic. Lalo.
Oh yeah, yeah,
God,
yeah.
He's so good. Yeah. I love that character.
Lalo's really good.
Oh, what a show. Anyway, I thought you always, that's weird. I thought your answer used to be L.A. Law, a show that nobody's heard of.
No. There was, and we talked about, it was not L.A. Law, it was a Victor Garber show.
What is that? Yeah. That's the one I'm thinking of.
That was called, oh God, that only lasted for a season. And what they did was, it was kind of a reverse Law and Order. Like you saw the team, the defense team, it was a high-powered big,
is it called, you know, Justice?
It could have been called Justice, yes.
Oh, produced by Jerry Bruckheimer. Ugh,
I'm telling you, it was the only time. What you did was, right, you saw them work up the case from the evidence that they had, mm-hmm. and then the last 10 minutes of the show was you got to see what actually happened, right? Mm. And to me, like, that's what I love, because the thing that always kind of breaks, you know, not breaks the fourth wall, but like the thing that's difficult about watching legal dramas is that when you watch a movie, when you watch a TV show, you as the audience know more than the lawyers ever know. So, and Morgan, hi Morgan, points out, I didn't get the movie. Every courtroom scene in My Cousin Vinny is fantastic. We have to say this all the time, like, other than our April Fool's joke, we'll never do My Cousin Vinny as a laud awful movie, because it's a laud fantastic movie. They had a team of lawyers working with the scriptwriters, and like they get direct examination. Like, it's really, really good. So
surprising. Yeah. I never would have thought that just in knowing nothing. But maybe what 2020 needs is lawful good, laud good movies. Because
lawful good movies. That's a good D&D joke.
Another question that we already sort of answered, but it has a lot of heart, so I want to make sure we do it because people are interested in it. Hagbird Celine asks, if you could change any Supreme Court decision, what would it be and why?
Oh God, boy, that's a tough one.
Marbury v.
I go back in time, kill my own grandfather. So we've talked about some of the like historically terrible decisions. So I think what you're looking for is something that is relatively modern, but outside the past 5 years, right? Because I don't really know what's going, like it's sort of hard to pick an individual decision that's bad about the Roberts Court, because the Roberts Court is a giant steaming pile of shit, right? So,
if you change one decision, they'll be like, fine, we'll just do the next one. We'll ruin it next time. It's fine.
But that being said, like, I think I honestly think if DC v. Heller had gone the other way, right? If we had told right-wing activists, like, yep, you took your shot, and you know what? You got 4 votes, but you can't conquer the Supreme Court by having Scalia write angry dissents and, like, pretending what the law is. So,
imagine how many lives that decision maybe could have saved.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Christopher Harrell says Bush v. Gore, which is kind of cheating, but that's a fantastic
choice. Well, I don't know why that's cheating, just because it was a weird per curiam opinion, or why is that cheating?
It's cheating because, when I think about bad decisions, I think about those that have precedential value, right?
And
Bush v. Gore was just like the conservatives on the Supreme Court were like, we would like George Bush to be
president. I would just like to point out that's cheating according to the rules you're making up in your head. The question was just if you could change a Supreme Court decision.
Right.
You're cheating because I have a whole system.
I hold myself accountable to the rules that I invent in my head.
So, I was like, why is that cheating? What am I missing? Good. I really like your DC v. Heller answer. Who knows how many people could be alive that aren't because of that. Who knows? I don't know.
Yep.
It'd be hard to tell. Okay, let's see. This is another. Physicians for a National Health Program asks, what are the laws on being naked in your own house? Do you have, this is probably applicable to a lot of people right now. We're a few months too late on this one. Do you have to keep the windows covered, or is it on everyone else to just not look? And, you know, there was that viral one, I think it was in Utah, that story everybody shared some months ago. That was like, woman convicted of nudity in her own house or something.
What was that? All right. I don't remember that story, but I could probably pull that tab up in a, you know, private window if need be.
I don't think there's pictures of it.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, then never mind. Not going to do it. So let's break this down a couple of ways. Number one, don't take legal advice from a podcast. Number two,
take nudity advice from a podcast.
Number two, I don't know. Right. But number three, here's how I'm going to guess. Okay. And that is, those kinds of laws and ordinances are going to vary state by state and even locality by locality. Mm. And this shouldn't be hard to imagine, right? Because they're a function of population density, right? You live out on a farmhouse and your closest neighbor is 2 miles away, like, you know, helicopter away, my friend. Okay. Like there's literally nothing that's going to come into play there. I would suspect, right? So not only the larger the population density, the more strict the laws are. But also I would suspect that they would track kind of an inverse of where you have an expectation of privacy, right? So in other words, you know, like if, you know, there's this kind of weird confluence where when you turn the TV on and you turn the light on, then, you know, somebody can see your silhouette through the window. Yeah, like you're probably fine. But, you know, no drapes, you know, no blinds, no nothing, just stone cold walking by. Like, that probably does violate some local ordinances in deeply populated areas. But all of that, I got to tell you, all of that is a guess. I don't know. Yeah. I love the question.
I'm surprised more people didn't instantly know the Utah case I was talking about. It looks like Matthew Cravat does, but it was, from my memory, it was something like she was surprised by some kids coming in her house at a time when she didn't expect them or something like that. And was like convicted of that. Like,
and that's ridiculous. I remember that case. I wasn't sure that that's what you were referring to. Right. Because to me, that's very different than I want to strut around my house naked because, you know, the man's home is his castle. Right. Like whatever. Right. And look, I am positive that there are localities in which you can't, right? You know, New York City, I would be shocked if there was not a New York City ordinance about indecent exposure, even while in your house. Again, I could be wrong, but probably good to assume that there is. So
dumb. What a stupid case. Anyway, here's one that I just, you know, it's got 10 hearts, which is, you know, fine, but it's more for you. This is just more just because you need it. CU asks, baseball question, can a prospect skip the draft, go off to Japan, and come back as a free agent, skipping the Faustian contract?
Ooh, CU, Kangshi, thank you so much. Love baseball questions. Simple, straightforward answer, no. You may not do that. And if you were thinking about doing that, you would also need to know that, like, right now the relationship between U.S. Major leagues and the Japanese NPB, Nippon Professional Baseball League, has a whole bunch of other restrictions on it as well, right? So, like, those teams, for example, can only carry, like, four, I think it is, American or foreign players, right? Which prevents you from, well, you think about that, right? Like, if the NPB, I've heard, is described as like kind of equivalent to a double A league, somewhere between double A and triple A. And so, you know, if you could all of a sudden game the system by having like the Hanshin Tigers sign like every 6-year minor league free agent, you know, it was like right on the cut, then all of a sudden, you know, you wouldn't, like, you know, you would lose kind of that quality of, you know, being a hometown team, right? So, so limits on number of foreign-born players that can be on a Japanese team. The Japanese teams, like the way in which you get released from those contracts, those you wind up having to you have to pay a release fee to the team, right? So you have to not only sign the player, but they have a posting fee, and the team that that pays the largest amount to the team then gets an exclusive rights to negotiate with that player. All of that is to say that one of the things that has been potentially discussed in baseball is a global worldwide draft. Whether that will come to play, I would say is far less likely now, given what a gigantic clusterfuck baseball is. And you know, if we wanted to riff on
because
that,
because a bunch of billionaires want more money, right?
Yeah. Because that's exactly right. Because a bunch of billionaires said we want, even though baseball players have agreed to prorated contracts, they were like, well, we're losing out on revenue because there won't be fans in the stands. So we want to be made whole on that. And the thing I will never I understand some of it, but like I just don't understand the dynamic of where like the average, you know, your proverbial fan in a bar is like super pissed off at like, well, that millionaire making money, you know, playing a kid's game, but like never mad at the like billionaire team owners that are like, well, we want to cut your salaries 30% so that, you know, the team owner can buy his yacht a new yacht, right? Like, it's mind-boggling to me. But there you go. There's no way around the restrictive baseball system. And
it's funny because Americans are so stupid. And I was talking to my brother about this because the three of us talked about this at some point, and he always is reminded of it. But people will defend to the death your right to be a billionaire or whatever in this country, even though the odds of you owning a Major League Baseball team, Andrew, are nothing, right? I mean, like, the odds of you becoming a Major League Baseball player are already nothing. The odds of you owning a team are less than nothing, right? Like, you're not going to be that guy.
Look, everyone watching this live stream can see me. You and I have hung out together. Right now, the odds of me owning a Major League Baseball team are less than the odds of me playing for a Major League Baseball team.
Hey, right? I could, you never know, like lots of injuries, and I operate a vending stand or something in the stadium. And then they're like, okay, we need you, kid. And I'm like, I don't even know how to play. And they're like, it's fine.
Yeah.
The odds of that happening are more than the odds of me. Because it's not just that you have to be a billionaire, which is already like, you know, what is it, a few hundred or something in this country? You have to be like specifically a billionaire who like one of a few billionaires who either already owns a team or something. You know, it's impossible.
Peter Curtis says, unless we all up our pledges a lot, which
there's only one way to find out.
You win the night, Peter.
Only one way to find out. We want to be scientific about it. All right. Let's. We all indulged Andrew's baseball fetish.
Thank you.
No, I'm just kidding. Okay, here's the question.
Oh, God. Wait. But
what?
8 seconds more on baseball.
Oh,
John Ronald says George W. Bush inherited a baseball team. Not true. And in this book behind me, Off Base, which you can still find in, you know, remnant bins off of Amazon, I discuss that what George Bush did was he was allowed to buy a percentage of the Texas Rangers for, I believe, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, $10,000.
Wow.
That turned out to be worth several million dollars immediately upon execution, right? Like, it was very clearly criminal behavior.
Almost like he was born on third base.
Yeah, almost more like he was born on third base and thought he'd hit a double.
All right, let's get to – so this question's a little technical, but it's got a lot of hearts. People want to know. Matthew asks, in case you didn't already answer this in today's episode – would a D.C. Court of Appeals writ of mandamus preclude Judge Sullivan from dismissing the case without prejudice contrary to the DOJ's request. Also, would dismissal in this case preclude future FARA charges, or does his plea agreement withstand all this? Help people like me remember what all of that means.
Yeah, this is the best law question we've been asked, and I appreciate that it's up on the YouTube because I can remember most of it. But being able
it's going
to
disappear very fast.
Okay, all right. Well, sorry. In any event, I think I can now having read it, I can answer every component of this. First, one of the reasons you can recognize that Naomi Rao's opinion in the D.C. Circuit is unbelievably poorly written is that the mandate doesn't specify whether the dismissal should be with or without prejudice, right? Hmm. It does not say, and because that's what you get when you get mandamus, mandatory, tell a buddy to do a thing, right? Like, but it doesn't tell Judge Sullivan the thing to do. The D.C. Circuit Court order, mandate will not take effect for 21 days from the issuance of the opinion. So I check this every single day. I checked this morning. So far, it has not been noticed for en banc review by the full D.C. Circuit. I am as confident as I have ever been about anything, some of which I've been wrong about, that it will, that one of the judges and or Judge Sullivan will petition for en banc review of that grotesquely stupid and terrible opinion. But so to answer Matthew's question, one, we don't know, based on that opinion, whether Judge Sullivan could just dismiss without prejudice. If it's dismissed without prejudice, he could be charged with all the stuff that he was presently charged with. The second half, you know, including everything that, you know, is in his present plea agreement. The second half of the question, I actually asked this of Randall Eliason because I think it was Glenn Kirshner commented like, hey, you know, the silver lining in this bullshit opinion Yes, I'm just sitting there, like, trying in my head, and I'm tripping over, was it Glenn Kirshner or not? It definitely was Glenn Kirshner, right, who said, look, the silver lining in this turd is that you could take Flynn and in January of 2021 charge him with all of the FARA violation stuff with respect to Turkey. And my response to that was twofold, right? It was, number one, Glenn, you're missing the point, right? I don't really care how much time, if any, that Michael Flynn spends in jail, right? Like, we talked about this on the show. It's not about...
It's in my brief. It's featured heavily in my brief.
Right. It's not about, like, punishing Flynn. It's about the rule of law. And so the idea that, like, oh, well, we could come back and get, you know, even more serious. Like, even if you could, you've missed the point. But number two, I was not certain how much of that, because as far as I can tell, and Randall Eliason agreed with me on this point, although he thinks that the FARA stuff was not in the information. Here's the way that you analyze that. When you dismiss something with prejudice, and I am applying my civil law experience here because I've never done it in the criminal law context before. When you dismiss a case with prejudice, you dismiss that case plus everything that, quote, arose out of the same transaction or common nucleus of operative facts, okay?
Interesting.
That's the rhetoric we use in a civil lawsuit. And the reason you do that is because otherwise you could immediately see the potential for abuse, right? Like, I sue you for breach of contract. Court dismisses that with prejudice. I then sue you for tortious interference with contract, and I'm alleging the same facts from the same thing, right? And eventually the court's like, you don't understand, Mr. Torres. We said we're done here, right? Good day. I say to you, good day, right? That's what dismissing with prejudice is, right? So anything that's in the information, that common nucleus of operative facts, would be barred from being subsequently the subject.
Even if
of,
it
of
was a charge that was bargained down, so they never actually charged him for the serious thing.
But here's right, and here's the flip side of that. And again, I just have to go back and match up. And I haven't done this. I have to concede that I have not. Anything that's not in the information, right, that was not allocuted in open court as I am pleading guilty to this set of facts is fair game, even if it was part of the plea agreement, because the plea agreement is now torn up, right? If we're not prosecuting you, there's nothing we've agreed not to also prosecute you for, because there's no plea agreement. We've torn that up. So it really comes down to what elements of the FARA violation are present in Flynn's information, to which he allocated twice in front of U.S. district court judges and said, I wish to plead guilty. I'm not still angry about this. I'm still really fucking angry about this. And I think, deferring again to Randall, that the FARA stuff is not – you could make a FARA case – based on stuff that's not in the information. But again, Randall and I both agree, like, that's not the way that this should be, right? Like, it's not about eventually prosecuting him or prosecuting him for state law crimes, if there are any of those, right? Like, it's about, this is a dude who went around the country shouting, lock her up, and then represented the incoming president-elect to a hostile foreign power without disclosing that to the United States, and then lied about that. And, like, you should fucking be guilty. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, and the corruption of him getting on. Yeah, it's just nuts. So, okay, here's one that we'll do quickly. I probably am not going to have a good answer that I remember, but just in case you have a better memory than I do. What's the biggest story that broke while you were recording an OA episode?
Oh,
gosh,
God.
I know there's been stuff. I mean, I know there's been, like, we recorded and then we're like, well, we're recording tomorrow as well. Or maybe even recorded that day more. I can't remember.
Yeah. yeah, we have done – let's think about that. So the some of the biggest ones that I remember were things that happened, like, 3 hours before we recorded,
yeah,
right?
That,
like,
happens, you know, a lot.
Right. When the Mueller report got released on a Thursday morning. That was fucking fun. That's the big one that comes to mind right now. I think that there were details we did. Again, the whistleblower complaint was released on a Thursday. That was lovely. So there's been a lot that we've had to adjust on the fly in terms of things mooting out that My favorite is the one from a couple of weeks ago, in which I was talking about, you know, sort of what was left on the Supreme Court's docket. And we'd recorded that, and I pushed that off for a couple of weeks. Like, this is something I wanted to do as a Friday segment, and it kept getting bumped. It kept getting bumped. It was really important for us to talk about. So I made it a Tuesday main show of, right, here's the rest of the Supreme Court calendar. Here are the big cases that have not come out. Obviously, we're going to lose in, you know, a bunch of separate cases. And by the way, there are these 10 gun cases. And all it takes is 4 votes for the Supreme Court to grant cert. So we're going to get a shit ton of new certs on bad gun cases. And we recorded that on a Thursday to air on a Tuesday. And then Monday, just to fuck with me, the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court typically, as part of their calendar, they release opinions on a Tuesday, like they did today. They convened a special Monday session to release the opinions. That opinion included, was it the Dock opinion? I don't know. But one of the ones that I said, you know, it's definitely going the other way. And I was 100% wrong.
Yeah.
And they denied cert in all 10 of the gun cases. And I kind of felt like, all right, well, that's a, you know, 11 swings and misses. But
I think the best was obviously Matt Gaetz's secret son, Nestor, because that happened in between recording our episodes on Thursday, like, to, you know, not the last Thursday, probably the Thursday before, or whatever it was. And I could not stop thinking about it. That whole second episode we did, I was like, I can't stop thinking about Matt Gaetz being like, checkmate, libs. I've got a secret son that looks way too hot. You know, like, it was the weird. It's, I'm still, maybe that was all above board, maybe somehow. But what?
Oh, man.
I've never been more distracted. Episode. Just like, what? I was that meme that was that lady with all the triangles and stuff and the math. Like, I just was like, what is happening here? That was funny.
You can't do better than memes right now of the, like, the, you know, the lawyer white couple on their lawn with the assault weapons. But
They're nuts. Okay, let's see. Here's one that people want to know about. Steve S., and I, this is probably going to be the story you've told a million times, so maybe find a different one other than the opposing counsel that tried to falsify a document or whatever. But Andrew, what is the most obnoxious opposing counsel you've ever had to deal with?
Ooh, so that's not necessarily where I would go with, with most obnoxious, right? Like they were... Yeah, I never could tell.
They were perfectly cordial while they were falsifying documents.
So, look, I never could tell if the firm falsified the documents or the client did. Right? You know what I mean? Like, and it's just, it is what it is. One of the most, hi puppy, one of the most obnoxious opposing counsel that I ever had to deal with was literally 6 months after moving from Covington to Zuckerman, right? So I was a mid-level associate. And one of the things that I've noticed is that generally the shittier a lawyer you are, the more you feel like we have to fight on everything all the time, right? Including things like basic courtesy, right? Yeah,
scheduling, just anything.
And so this was a case in which, and I don't even remember what it was, right? There was some motion and our response was due that Friday. And it was Yom Kippur, right? Hmm. And I believe that's the first, it's in October. My apologies, those of the Jewish faith in the audience. But in any event, like, it's an October holiday, right? And I was an associate, and it was just me and the partner on the case. And the partner was Jewish and, you know, observed Yom Kippur. And so he was going to be out of the office starting at sundown. And so he was like, look, just send him an email and ask him if we can have until, you know, Tuesday. Mm-hmm. You know, if we can have 4 extra days. You know, one extra business day to file our response. And I did that. And I got back this like page long email explaining how they couldn't do that because the client was this or that or whatever. And like, I just called the partner and he was like, all right, well, you know, file something, whatever. and look, like I did that and it was fine and it went fine. But it was just kind of one of those things where you were like, I honestly can't believe.
Send a sternly worded crunch wrap?
When I filed it, I filed it with a footnote that said, you know, counsel requested an additional, you know, 48 hours of consideration, which was denied by
lawyer version of a sternly worded.
Of a sternly. Crunch. Yeah. There's an extra. And by the way, and since Morgan is in the audience here, I have to tell you, we have a case now that, will probably be the answer to this story 10 years from now, right? Like you never want to give like a current case as an example. But I have opposing counsel that literally has gone like months without returning emails and phone calls that like started an email thread with his client on it that I was like, I would prefer not to talk to your client. And he was like, well, my client would like to talk to you. And I was like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, this is not the way law is practiced. Right. But they have, at least
opening arguments. This is not the way law is practiced. That could be the
ask a question lawyer would ask.
The last 3 or 4 years of opening arguments could have been renamed to "This is not the way law is practiced." But sadly, the Corys and the other name, man. Justins. The Corys and the Justins.
Justin's and Corey's. So there you go.
Good anyway. Times. We got a one weird trick. You want to answer a one weird trick question?
I love one 20, weird trick.
Yeah. 20 people want to know the answer to as well, in all addition right. to Stormy Decisis. Oh, we have to have a question from Stormy Decisis.
Obviously. I forget Stormy, if we, are, we love
I don't
you.
I think we did. The Church of Universal Suffrage is a new religion that declares all election days to be religious holidays on which all believers are expected to stay home and meditate on the importance of voting. I'm pretty sure all states allow you to vote by mail or vote early if your religion's holiday falls on election days. Is this a viable way to force states to allow mail-in voting?
No.
Oh, okay. Sorry, Stormy.
Sorry, Stormy. No, and this is, I love the question. We love all Stormy questions, but this is a lesson that I learned from being a 20-something atheist coming out of law school and studying the Employment Division versus Smith decision, right? Because you read Employment Division versus Smith, and like, I'm shocked that we did not, while he was still alive, you know, hire Christopher Hitchens to like read the decision dramatically, right, in his, you know, stentorian voice. And like everything in that decision, you're like, yeah, that's right. Stick it to him, Antonin Scalia. And and if some part of you doesn't go, wait a minute, like Antonin Scalia is not my friend here, then you're probably a 20-something law student, right? Which I was. And so what should have been obvious to me, but was not, was, oh, yeah, this is going to be used to stomp on brown people with their weird, you know, religions. But there's not a chance in hell that this is going to be used against Antonin Scalia's preferred religion of Catholicism. Same thing here. There is zero where the Supreme Court is headed. And again, right, today's decision is 100% in line with that. Don't think we're not going to talk about it on Friday. Don't think we're not going to have Andrew Seidel come back on and do a deep dive at some point, right? Like we got all that coming for you guys. But there's this is about when we talk about the way the Supreme Court's jurisprudence has moved. It has moved towards respect for your sincerely held religious beliefs, with a foundation of an establishment clause accommodationism jurisprudence that still, right, Smith is still good law, right? So in other words, there's no way that an oddball minority religious decision is going to take advantage of where the court is right now, because this is not – there's nothing from a jurisprudential standpoint that can make sense of where the court is on – religious issues, other than they're Christians and they like Christians and now maybe Jews. Right. I'm super pessimistic on that. I'm really, really bummed. I have to tell you, like, I don't know if Andrew's in the audience. But like the heart, again, we knew this was coming today, but like the heartbroken texts that I got from Andrew Seidel are like, would make you choke up. I don't think I'm talking out of school by saying that. Like, there's somebody who has devoted his adult life to the principle of separation of church and state. And, you know, today the Supreme Court was like, well, yeah, nah. But like, does it have to be separate? Or yeah. Could it really be like intermingled together such that we're giving tax dollars to churches and that's really the same thing? So, yeah.
All right. Well, on a lighter note, here's a question that we can probably fight about slash every... Ooh. Every liberal fight me about. Tulsa, come for the 1/3 full arena, stay for the COVID ass. Were you a West Wing fan? Fucking no. I am the only liberal who doesn't like every. I hate Aaron Sorkin. I get art is subjective. You love it. It's fine. Just disagree with me. Every Aaron Sorkin character is the same person. It's Aaron Sorkin having an argument with himself that he thinks is really clever. Every scene is the same fucking scene with the pitter patter argument. I hate it. Absolutely hate it. That's Thomas, my answer. How about you?
Thomas, come closer to the screen.
Nah.
Yeah, come a little closer. No, it's all
staying
good.
Here. It's I COVID. Just I'm social distancing. Sorry.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I can hear you from here.
I I tried on multiple occasions to watch The West Wing, and I was unable to do so.
Good, because you're smart.
For precisely the reasons that you've described. And, like, people have sent me the clips of, like, you know, here's this dramatic, like,
speech. Oh, yeah, remember when President Bartlett or whatever the fuck, he really tells that woman off, and I'm like, fucking shut up. That's not real. It's not real.
And it just, like, it never did. So I've never seen a full episode of The West Wing.
Me neither. I've seen parts of a lot of them.
I feel good about it.
So yeah. There we go. Thank you. That's why, and thus a podcast was born. Even though we didn't know about it. I also want to point out, they also ask, what's your guilty pleasure TV show or movie? You know, I'm just a turd, I guess, because I don't think I have that. Like, I either like things or I don't. Is this why there are so many bad TV shows? Because people are like, well, sometimes I want to just watch a show where it's a bunch of idiots doing something, you know, like, because I see these shows and I'm like, who watches this? And maybe that's it. Guilty pleasure. What's a guilty pleasure? My guilty pleasure is I like good shows, so I watch good shows. I don't know.
Well, no. So there are shows that I like to put on in the background and, right, like that you don't want to analyze, right? So I will not take the easy way out and say Transformers cartoons.
Sure. Yeah, no, right? That's true. That's a guilty pleasure. No, I'm sure I have them. I can't.
But things that I will put on, like, I love, it's ridiculously formulaic, but, like, I love Bar Rescue on in the background. Like, I just, everything about, like, big fat John Taffer running in and going, shut it down. Like, it's just, it's glorious in how bad it is. And, you know, and, like, everything is going to, it's going to be like, oh, there's, we're 27 minutes in. Where's the emotional breakdown of the bar owner? Like, it's just, I love that. I love the cooking shows. I will tell you, I feel like, and maybe I'm deluding myself, but I've known a half dozen people who have competed on Top Chef.
Nice.
I love That's Top awesome. Chef. And they've all kind of backed up, right? Like, so Tom Colicchio will say in public, like, we do not, like, this is not a reality show where the producers are like, this guy has more drama, so keep him around. Hmm. You know, that it seems to be roughly correlated to quality of making food. And obviously, like, I love making food. So,
yeah.
So those are my reality shows.
I guess
shows
the closest
that
I could say is Lydia got me into Queer Eye, which is, I don't know, is that a guilty pleasure? I'm kind of tired of it now because I've gotten loaded up on it. We've watched all the new ones, I guess. Yeah. And, It's good, but it's starting to get a little.
I've hung out with Ted Allen for a little bit, so you know.
Who's Ted Allen?
He was the original.
Oh, the original. Oh, I only know the new one. I never watched.
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry. And by the way, here's my. I got to pull my Megatron off the shelf from behind me, so there you go.
Nice.
Oh, Peter Curtis says loved Iron Chef. So did I. I wish they would rerun the original Japanese Iron Chef, which. I watched in law school, like, religiously. Those were so good.
Okay, here's my closest thing to a guilty pleasure movie, but I still think these are just fucking great movies. I love the Kill Bill movies. They're so good. Yeah. They're just good, though. I mean, I guess it's guilty, but it's like a fighting and stuff, so maybe that's, I don't know, maybe that's a guilty pleasure, but God, I love those movies. So good. All right, we can move on to
Tarantino.
Ooh, hold on. Here's a good, we got a good, marketing opportunity question, Andrew. Maybe.
All right.
Tom Rosser Davies asks, how does Andrew feel about Legal Eagle's lawsuit against the federal government? And I don't know what all those letters stand for, but.
There are letters?
Yeah, there. Is it? Let's see. I don't know. SMAKIBBFB. Is that. Does that mean something to you?
That doesn't mean anything to me. Since you guys showed up for our live Q&A, we will tell you. Next Tuesday's episode, we're going to have our buddy Devin Stone, the Legal Eagle himself, come on and do an extended interview. And if it's anything like the last time, like, we're going to try and do like a 35-40 minute interview, and it's going to go like 7 hours.
That's a great guest. Letting you folks in on a little inside information, which I'll just speak in generalities. In podcasting, there are guests who are good guests. And there are guests who are fine. And then there are guests who are awful. We don't have a lot of those. But Yeah, Legal Eagle is a great guest. That's a guest where you're like, we're having Legal Eagle on. What are we talking about? Who gives a shit? It'll be awesome. Like, whatever it is, it'll... There's those people, you know, and there are a number of them, and they're always, as podcasters, I'm sure, I know we have a lot of podcasters in the audience as well who do their things too. Like, there really is a difference between, like, people where you're, like, squeezing, like, please give me something. I've had a lot of those interviews on SIO. Like, I am really trying to just talk, you know, like, the people will give, like, one word, yep, no, you're like, what do you think this is? Like, anyway, so, yeah,
in the Q&A, have I told the first season Conan O'Brien Smurf story?
No, I don't know. I don't remember.
So this was first season Conan O'Brien when he got the show and it was on at like 2 a.m. and no one watched it and he'd never hosted a show before and he could only get like, you know, Q-level guests and would do things like light his desk on fire in the middle of interviews because he would have those like podcastingly bad interviews, right? Where like someone would come out and like... And he would just like look at the screen and be like, all right, well, I'm going to light my desk on fire now, right? And he only ever did that once, but it was fantastic. He did a send-up of that, and it was obviously a plant, but it is still one of the funniest things I've ever seen on television. I know you can find the clip on YouTube. So it was Conan O'Brien said, all right, when we come back from the break, we're going to have Thomas Smith, who is the world's largest collector of Smurf memorabilia.
Gosh, I think maybe you have told... Now it's ringing a bell, but that's okay.
And then came back from the break, and you see Thomas Smith there, and, like, there's thousands, tens of thousands of Smurf dolls and toys and little plastic figurines and lunchboxes and everything else. And he looks over, and he's like, so, Thomas, how'd you get into Smurf collecting? And Thomas says... I don't want to talk about the Smurfs.
Yeah.
But it's so good. It is so good that in my family, like, I don't want to talk about the Smurfs is now like a common
refrain. Yeah, that's refrain exactly. That it's people so are good. Making jokes, by the way, about Eli Bosnick, and I'm sure you're just joking. That he is the opposite of it. He is the best guest on anything. You need people who are able to talk and are funny, which Eli's the best at. And also, it's the important part is, guests need to have a regard for how the audience what feels like. There's guests where they don't seem to care that they're not giving anything to the audience. Like it's almost like it's an imposition on them that they're there. And you're like, well, just say no. Like when I guest on stuff, which I haven't for 1,000 years, whenever somebody asks me, I will either not do it because I don't have time, or I'm going to go and do my best to be entertaining because if somebody's listening to me, I want to try to do my best to be entertaining. But there are people who are immune to that, and it blows my mind. Weirdest thing. Sorry, touched a nerve. Hey, here's a fun question that I'm sure people will love, and you can feel free to decline to answer if you want to. But SCOTUS now hiring Sharktacons asks, if you had written the amicus brief for a different organization and were billing for it, what would that bill look like?
Ooh,
I know you put a lot of hours into that, and yeah, Morgan so
I
as
love,
well, of course.
I love everything about that. I love the idea that the SCOTUS is now hiring Sharktacons.
Yeah.
I was watching in the chat, and people were like, apparently on the Amicus Brief episode, which dropped for everybody today, I was not super clear on Morgan's relationship to the firm. She's my associate. She's a year and a half out of law school and is by far the lawyer with her level of experience, you know, has a judgment that kind of goes beyond, you know, only being out of law school for, you know, less than 2 years that I've ever met. She's super smart. She kind of works at this, right? Like I feel like I'm on the bleeding edge of how, you know, angry and that you can get in pleadings and, you know, and Morgan like is kind of, you know, ramps it up to 14, which I love because it, you know, it causes me to kind of come back and take a look at everything. So, the amicus brief, I think I said this on the show, we really worked that up like a big firm. And Morgan and I and Rich Gilliland, who's our law clerk, worked around the clock, including on weekends. If you're patrons, you know, because you got updates at like 2 a.m. on Saturday for 3 weeks. So it's not hard to kind of punch that out. So if I were at Covington, if we were all at Covington, here's how that would have built out. I would be billing out at $1,100.
Well, lest before you cheat at the question, yeah. This is actually in the question. This isn't something I'm making up. They're asking how much you would have billed, not like if I worked for a large.
They said
if you were doing it like for on behalf of an organization and were billing them for
it. If it were, and I represent a nonprofit. I represent a couple right now, but I represent one fairly large nonprofit. And if they had asked us to do the amicus brief and had wanted a fixed fee, we probably would have billed them $25,000 for it. And that would have been a massive discount on the hourly rates.
I'm sorry, Morgan. I'm guessing you didn't make much.
None of us made any of that.
You're paying Morgan, right?
Yeah, Morgan got paid for her hours.
Yeah, I was going to say. I'm sorry. That's what I was saying.
But
you probably only get like $20,000, I'm guessing, Morgan, something like that for it. So. Do you want to try to lightning? We're almost out of time, and I actually do have to leave on time. So we'll try to do some lightning. This question I like. Can I get down to it? Oh, sorry. The window is. Can I make this happen? Oh, that's not it. Oh, whoa. Man. It's at the bottom, so it won't. The way the stupid. Oh, wait. Hold on. Let me do a trick. Magic trick here. No, that's not going to do it either. Oh, no. It almost did it. Hold on. What a stupid thing. What if I do that? There we go. Okay. Had to totally mess up anything. Rimmer, I barely knew her. I think it should be knower, right? Anyway, since Andrew has purported to have seen unredacted portions of the Mueller report, and by the way, I think everyone can. That's not a secret thing, right? So tell the story of how that happened. And also, the question is, does he think there's anything Bill Barr redacted which he lawfully shouldn't have? And if so, if the unredacted material was released, do you think he would face scrutiny over why he chose to redact it that way?
Yeah. So great question. And I was trying to pull up in a side window, but I can't. The judge who had seen in camera the unredacted Mueller report and ordered it released. Remember that the redactions fell into different categories, right? So the largest category was HOM. Harm to ongoing matter. So the version that I have seen that we have linked in the show notes that you guys can all go see has those harm to ongoing matter redactions removed because there are no more ongoing matters, right? And the primary one there is were information related to Roger Stone. We're going to do this, whether we do it on a Patreon bonus or a Tuesday. I don't know. It depends on how fucked the country is, which is, you know, pretty fucked. So we'll find out. There is definitely, we've said that the Mueller report volume 2 documents 9 clear crimes for which Trump could and should have been impeached. Adding Roger Stone, you can now add a 10th, right? Huh. So,
That more noise I ordered. Why couldn't they have done that all at once? That would have been great.
There you go. So most of the unredacted stuff that I've seen relates to Roger Stone. And from what I have seen is fairly redacted when that was an ongoing matter. Now, there's still stuff that's redacted that is redacted as grand jury materials or whatever. And I just don't know what's underneath those. I went to look at the revised report. And so, for example, like the redactions on, I think it's Appendix C, which is the president's answers. There's still redactions there that strongly suggest crimes to me that I haven't seen. So there's your answer. Not exactly.
I don't think this is a lightning round question either, but I've actually been worried about this very thing. Quick opinion. Wade and Meyer asks, in regards to Breonna Taylor, can the officers involved actually be charged with anything related to her death? if I understand the facts of this case correctly, they had a signed warrant. They entered legally. They were shot at and returned fire. Because no-knock warrants were legal, it seems the only issue was in not identifying themselves in time. Is that enough to call what they did murder? If their warrant was obtained under false pretenses, as some have surmised, does that change things? There's a lot more to it, but let's stick to that. I've been really worried about this very thing because obviously this is stupid and it's horrible, but I wonder, like, if the problem is that the no-knock warrant is awful and we shouldn't even have those, will there be some legal problem where you can't really charge the officers because of the system in place?
So here's the way this breaks down. And I'm going to talk to you about the legal analysis and also the practical analysis. And let me cut to the chase on that, right? Like, the practical analysis is it's going to be a challenge, right? So here's the legal analysis. You establish that somebody meets the statute, right? That somebody has, right, committed a homicide, a murder, a manslaughter, whatever. And the officers, right, have clearly meet those requirements. And then the burden shifts to you as a defendant to offer an affirmative defense to having met that prima facie case, right? And the classic example of that is self-defense, right? So Thomas lunges at me with a knife. I pull a gun. I shoot him dead, right? The police probably don't charge me, but if they show up and arrest and charge me with second degree murder, excuse me, they've met their prima facie burden, right? I killed Thomas with a firearm, right? So and then the burden shifts to me to mount my affirmative defense to say that I was reasonably in fear of my life or imminent bodily harm, and that's why I killed you. And then that becomes a defense to that murder two charge. So in the Breonna Taylor case, the way that interacts is acting under color of law is an affirmative defense. And so then we have to drill down on, have they met their burden for an affirmative defense? And the arguments for it would be, if you could show the officers were acting in good faith, right? If no-knock warrants are permissible, right? But the arguments against it were like, and again, you know, we're not drilling into the facts, but like, right? Like, that wasn't her house, right? I mean, you know.
No, it was her house. So I believe the warrant was for her house, but I'm pretty sure, and people can correct me in the chat, that the person they were doing the no-knock warrant, who was alleged to have, like, received packages there, was already in custody at the time. And that is horrifying. So, like, could there be some sort of negligence in the issuing of the warrant? Is there anything there, or is that protected by... Go ahead.
That's protected by a warrant can be erroneously issued, but if you as a police officer rely on it in good faith, that then becomes a defense. And this is why when I said when it gets down to the practicalities, it's going to be a challenge. To prove you guilty of a crime, as we know, the burden of proof there is on the state to prove you guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, right? And that is a 95-5 or 90-10 standard. When you raise an affirmative defense, the standard is just preponderance of the evidence, right? Is it more likely than not that that affirmative defense is correct? So in other words, it's easier to establish your affirmative defense than it is for them to convict you in the first place. And look, there are lots of reasons why we want that to be the case, which, you know, we don't have time to get into here. But in this case, right, it strikes me. So basically what you're doing is you're saying, is it more likely than not, given the totality of the circumstances, right, that the warrant was something you could rely on or that the warrant was something you could not rely on? So that's yeah. How it's going to come out. We have not, and I want to, and you and I are both saying that, right? Like, we're not looking at the specific facts in regards to the gravamen.
I think this is why nothing has happened. Like, every time people are like, oh, Breonna Taylor's killers still haven't been arrested, I'm like, I don't know how you could. I don't understand what legal ground someone, a prosecutor, would actually charge them. Like, I want there to be consequences, and there should be consequences, but I don't know how legally we would do that. It's really depressing all around. There has to be an end to these bullshit no-knock warrants where you storm in, don't even announce that you're police. What about that part of it? Is that anything that legally we could do anything with if they didn't announce that they're police officers?
I would want, again, without rendering an opinion.
Sure.
It would go into that stew of is this, and the question is going to come down to, this is an affirmative defense. Did the officers act under color of law? Were they relying in good faith on something that they thought entitled them to behave in the way in which they did? And there are arguments in favor of that. There are arguments against it. Right. And and ultimately the question is, how does the jury resolve weighing those arguments together?
Well, sorry for going out on that depressing note. I realize I had a hard out, and here I am 5 minutes past when I said I had to go. Sorry, everybody.
There's not a fun one we can do real quick?
I'll try to find a quick fun one.
You've got little kids.
It's got to be very fast. Yeah, I have to go. Okay. I'm trying to find a quick one here. Nobody asks fun questions. Well, here we go. Josh Hoku asks, will someone bat 400 during a 60-game season?
Will they? I don't know. But obviously,
has anyone batted 400 in a full season, or what's
in a full season? Oh yeah, like all the time. Okay. Like Ty Cobb hit 420 once, right? Like,
oh, okay.
Somebody has not hit 400 since, St. Louis Cardinals, I think 1954. But it's been a long time since somebody's hit 400. Long time Padres great flirted with that, and the name is just because we're.
It's all right, I got to go, so don't worry.
Yeah, I know you do. It's much easier in a third the time. I want to leave this for our baseball fans.
Yeah, because didn't Bellinger that last year or the year before, wasn't he batting like insanely for the first half of the season?
Yeah, right. It's super easy to do it over a short
stretch. Oh, very easy, yeah.
It's still hard, but you know the exceptions are. I was saying this to my best friend earlier today. Everybody seems to think we're going to have a 60-game baseball season. And everybody is kind of focused on the idea of, you know, like you're a Dodgers fan, right? Like, yeah, but, you know, what if some shitty team gets hot for 60 games, right? And, you know, and the Dodgers finish third and don't make the playoffs or whatever, right? And I get that. But I kind of wanted to throw out the possibility that I think nobody is thinking about that given that what we're going to have is no spring training games, right? Mm. We're going to have 3 weeks of like spring training workouts with like three or four games period and a whole bunch of inter-squad games, but not like a typical.
Wait, is this
spring
actually
training.
Happening? I thought they couldn't.
Absolutely.
Agree to...
This is actually happening, right?
They finally agree.
Teams have their. We could do a deep dive on this and maybe
I
can finish it. I meant on the show.
Really have to go.
But I want to put out the possibility that, like, some team like the Orioles goes 3-57, right? That, like, that talent – because everybody seems to think, like, it's all going to be random because short season. Uh-huh. And I think it's possible, given short prep, that talent differences are magnified. And so, like, super shitty teams may get blown out
every single
game.
Or even so, the highs are higher
game.
And the lows are
lower.
Yeah. Okay.
And nobody seems to be thinking about that. I throw that out there.
Well, there you have
great
it.
Way
that's
to end.
Author of the – oh, shit. Le fucking off base. What's your book? Damn it. I had it and I lost
off
it.
Base. Off base.
Off base. Yeah, I said it. Okay, off base. That's what – yeah. Author of Off Base, Andrew Torres. Thanks for coming on the show. Talking about baseball stuff. No, thanks everybody for the Q&A. That was lots of fun, and we will see you very soon. What is it? There are a couple days here, so we'll see you then. We love you so much. Bye bye.
Thank you.